This is the Ask Falaschini podcast, where the modern economy is discussed from a skeptic's perspective. Mr. Falaschini helps you distinguish what is sustainable in our economy and what isn't. Not everything that glitters is gold, and not all mud is dirty. The podcaster Mr. Falaschini provides no-nonsense advice. He had it all, lost it all, went bankrupt multiple times, and is now attempting to come back from zero with sustainable growth. There are numerous coaches and preachers on the internet that preach about positive thinking and how life is all roses if you just care to see it that way. Well, Mr. Falaschini is definitely not one of them. We recommend you ask Falaschini to keep it real. He discusses the darker side of the current economic reality, the side that's more important for your personal and business finance. His first intention is to help you keep what you already have. Not to be a complete party pooper, Mr. Falaschini will also hint at the earning opportunities in the economy today. In order to please the almighty algorithm, please like, share, and subscribe. And now it's time to start taking notes. The mic goes to the podcaster, the one and only Mr. Falaschini.
Welcome to the Ask Falaschini podcast with a guest. I'm proud to present Rich Edwards from New York. Rich is a Bachelor of Science in Engineering, Master of Business Administration, and has served as an engineering officer in the U.S. Army. Rich led IBM Watson development cloud strategy, enabling banks and financial firms to pioneer data-driven ML approaches ahead of the curve. Rich is now the CEO of MindSpam Systems, helping community financial institutions transform themselves with data-driven strategies and technologies. His area of expertise is the convergence of analytics, marketing, artificial intelligence, and machine learning for a financial institution. Rich, please tell us more about yourself. What is your story?
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of come talk to you and your audience. I had a very kind of unconventional, I guess, career path. I spent a little time in the military in the late 90s. Eventually ended up at IBM and kind of actually ended up working in the mainframe business, which at the time, even then, it was like over 50 years old, which was odd. You know, even as an IBM employee, I didn't really realize how big and how dependent the financial markets and banking system was on it. But I spent several years there in product management, really getting to learn the requirements of that industry, particularly when it came to reliability and fault tolerance and high availability and disaster recovery. And then largely because I kind of knew how to get things done within the IBM machine, I got tapped to go work in what was then a new business unit around artificial intelligence and eventually became Watson around the developer cloud offering, which was, hey, we want to let our customers build on top of the technology that went into a lot of the stuff, like the work that started in the Jeopardy work, and then eventually you kind of saw in the TV commercials around cancer research and cancer treatment, but to do that across different domains and really use point solutions that, you know, you could build on top of. It was like an API platform that we built on top of this. And this was pretty early on. This was, you know, 2013, 2014 when we were rolling out with that. And that was an exciting time to be in that business, that kind of like coming out of that AI winter, right? When everything started to take off. And me being the guy that had all this time working in mainframe and with banking clients, I was kind of the guy that went to talk to financial institutions in the financial services industry a lot. So I did that for several years and then moved on and ended up joining MindSpam as the CEO. And, you know, really what we do now is help smaller institutions, community banks, credit unions. You know, in the U.S., there's a regulatory hurdle at about the $10 billion mark, and that's a good demarcation between the larger regional or national bank and the smaller community financial institutions. We work on the small end and really help them better use their data to provide more personalized service to their customers, because that's really where the value is, right? There's some technical heavy lifting we do, but we help them with their value prop and how they help their customers.
Okay, when you're talking better service, are you implying of a decision-making process, or are you implying more about credit scoring and risk assessment with AI?
Yeah, no. Good point, right? Because there's a lot of different angles in there, a lot of different domains that come to play. So when you think about smaller financial institutions, community banks, credit unions, you know, places that maybe has a half dozen branches or maybe a single branch. When you ask them, hey, what's your competitive advantage, right? Like, how do you stand out amongst Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, right? The big heavies in the industry, they're like, almost universally, they will say, oh, it's our service level, right? And that plays into their business model. They typically have per customer, per dollar asset, you know, under not under management, but asset on their balance sheet, they will have way more people than a larger institution. Mm-hmm. And that has two angles to it, right? It's obviously not cost competitive from a labor hour, labor cost standpoint. They're less efficient, but they provide a level of service and care that you're just not going to get from a larger institution, right? So they'll have less breadth of offerings that they're able to bring to their customers. They have like a narrow set of core things that they do. But what they do is they help them in a very personal way, right? Typically, you know, when you're going into a branch or working in one of the digital channels for an institution to decide, like they know who you are. You're dealing with somebody who you've probably dealt with before, but even if you haven't, they live in the same community you do, right? Mm-hmm. It is very much local, close to the customer, close to what they're doing. They're tied in there. And that turns out to play into the business model somewhat, in that they are way over-indexed in their participation in small business funding. Mm-hmm. Particularly like in the U.S., Small Business Administration runs several loan programs that are way over-indexed on community FIs. And then also commercial real estate is another one, where mm-hmm. there are many smaller shops, other small businesses, malls, real estate developments that just would not happen without the participation of these groups, that because they're so close to their communities, because they have that tie of their working with their neighbors, they understand those markets much, much better. The dynamics, the local machinations, the politics, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that is to say, like, they are closer because of their proximity to their customers. So how does that play into data and everything when we kind of mm-hmm. get there? And it's really about, how do they use their data, particularly the data that they have that their larger competitors don't, that they're kind of new competitors that are coming out of financial technology, fintech companies don't have, you know, that intimacy they have with their customers. How do they use that across all their channels, right? One of the things they're exceptionally known for is their in-branch experience. You walk into a branch, which is like much closer to like a retail experience than anything else. Fantastic. Can't beat beat. They know you. They know what's going on. It's a discussion about, you know, high school football. It's, you know, very close. And like, I'm here talking to my neighbors. When you take a step back, you go out the door and it's the extended ATM network, their web portal, web experience, their own app experience through their partners, that begins to fizzle, right? It gets a little less personal. And that's largely because they're not well served by their traditional technology partners. There's a handful of core banking providers. There's three that have better than 85% of the market penetration mm-hmm. for banks of this size. And they're really not interested in developing that part of the business for them, right? And frankly, this is not an area that they really have developed all that well. And you kind of saw this in the early 10s through the late 10s of like less and less banking, less and less foot traffic at the local branch. more and more digital traffic. And then like COVID accelerates that, right? Like 5-10 years. And so now they find themselves in a position where they're still maintaining what's going on. Even if you look at like the emerging banking crisis that we're seeing with some of like the high profile regional bank failures, when you look at like the assets that are moving around, community banks are doing very well. Overall, there's a decline in deposits that we've seen, particularly year to date, like in 1Q23, as we're looking at. But community banks are overperforming. They are doing much better than except the largest banks, and you have to factor in some acquisitions there. But except for the very, very largest banks, these small institutions, they're holding on to their customers. Like they have immense amount of loyalty. And so the question becomes, how can they do better in what they offer their customers and how they give them that personalized experience using what they know about, right? Using what they have. And this is largely an asset that's been untapped to them. Now, very long answer to your question, back to where we started with. It's like, is it credit? Is it risk management? Is it more marketing automation? I mean, the answer ultimately is yes. It's all of that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that they tap into that pretty much any FI does, right? You get a credit card offering, you're typically pre-qualified, right? You know, and that's kind of coming from either data that they have, data that they buy from like a credit rating agency or somebody like that, or a marketing agency, and then tie in with what they know about you, your experience that way. And that handles some of that. Plus there's some regulatory concerns that they have to address. You know, banking is a regulatory environment. And that's one not terribly differentiated. I mean, pretty much every bank is going to have an operation like that. Where it gets into it is more, they know you, they know where you are, they know probably 3 or 4 dozen different life events that you're going to go through, or you might go through, that have a financial component to them. That you will, first time going through it, you might need help, right? Getting married, buying a house for the first time, moving for a job, having children for the first time, kids starting to drive, kids going to college, right? Like all of these things you kind of go through, you might only do once as a person, but they have helped people with that in context many, many, many times, right? And again, coming into the branch, hey, I have this situation going on, or I'm going to ask you to do this transaction. Very naturally, it's always like that, oh, what's going on? Why are you doing that? And then understanding like they're going through something, like they're having this life event that we can help them with, maybe much broader than the thing they just came in here to ask us about, right? And being able to do that proactively, being there ahead of time, you know, being able to predict, hey, at this person, where they are, what we know about them, they're probably in the market for this thing that we can help them with. Mm-hmm. Let's reach out to them ahead of time. And a lot of times you start talking about, you know, from a marketing standpoint, like next best offer, right, is the term for this a lot of times. Can you predict, based on what you know about this person, where they are, what they've done, maybe the behavior that they've done? And it could be as simple as, this is somebody who's come to our website 3 times now and looked at the rates around home loans. They're probably in the market for a house. We should probably reach out to them and say, buying a house? Here's all the ways that we can help you, right? Some of which is advice and pointing you in the right direction and maybe our channel partners for realtors. But then also, here's our rates for mortgages, second mortgages, vacation homes, like the whole portfolio, what they have available to them. Mm-hmm. So it's being smart about that, right? And a lot of this is analogous to what you see in branch, what they do, right? If somebody comes in and, you know, they ask for, you know, what the rates are, pick up a brochure about a particular product, that teller that they're dealing with, their personal banker, is going to ask them about that, right? And they're going to have a conversation, and it's going to go probably beyond what they came in for. And the whole point is, well, how do you do that in a digital team? How do you do that with particularly an emerging generation that's digital native, that is maybe not allergic to coming into the branch, but certainly is a lot less likely to do that. And you're a lot less likely to have a one-on-one personal interaction with them, right? So
yep.
that's part of how that plays out.
Two more questions that I think our audience would like to hear. One is, do you think that a small business should focus on communal banking and not the mainstream banks?
Yeah, that's a good question. It very much depends on what your situation is. And you've seen a lot more narrow niche service providers. Perfect example. A couple of weeks ago, you had Maxwell Mia, who was an Australian family office financial service provider, financial advisor, right? There's a perfect example of a thing that has existed for some time, but you were very, very high net worth to have a family office, right? But now you're beginning to see that trickle down. It's more and more available. You have like a lower amount of assets that maybe, hey, a family office might make sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're a small business and you're in a community, and you know, there are plenty of community banks that specialize just in certain types of funding, right? One of the things that I've seen, particularly back to the SBA program, right? There are a number of firms that just focus on specific industries. Mm-hmm. One that's very well known is dental practices, right? You come out of dental school and you're going to start a local dental practice. There's probably three or four national providers that will do all of your financing, plus connect you with a whole network of service providers that you're going to need to start your practice, set it up. But they're there to kind of do all the underwriting from a loan standpoint, from helping you identify a lease for a retail space, from financing equipment that's in there. And all of those things are categorized in different ways. And, you know, they know how to do this because they've done it thousands of times for how to set, you know, how to finance a dental practice. They know how to do that. Same thing for retail stores, same things for different type of industry verticals. So from that standpoint, you can probably find a specialist that is either in the size of business, the specific industry you're in, or the domain of work that you're doing. You can find somebody who has done that exact thing hundreds, if not thousands of times, and is going to provide you much, much more service and much, much more value than just providing money, just providing a checking account, just providing a loan, just providing payment services, for example, right? They're going to give you the expertise of this is what really good looks like. I know when I was, I actually purchased Mindspan Systems. It existed before me, and I bought it from the person who was running it before. One of the best advisors I had when I went through that process was actually my insurance broker. And, you know, I bought liability insurance and cybersecurity insurance, and we did workers' comp and, you know, everything else that we needed to do to get started. But he was immensely valuable to me in advice in identifying other professionals that I needed, advice in how I handled some contract terms, things that were not exactly in the domain of insurance. Mm-hmm. But because he worked with professional services firms and had worked with companies like me, he was able to give me way more value than just the thing that I bought from him, right? And so a lot of community FIs provide similar expertise in these like narrow niches, in these like domain specific situations.
So by all means, small business owners should get in contact with local banks and try to get as much out as possible, not just money.
At the very least, do your homework. Right. Mm-hmm. Look for a good reference. But all I'm saying is don't confuse small with less capable. because mm-hmm. that is not always the case, particularly when it comes to domain specific. And the like I mentioned, the dental practice, but the one that's really outsized is commercial real estate. Like that, there is a whole industry, a whole segment of, at least in the U.S., a whole segment of the economy that is way over indexed in the industry knowledge, the ability to be both effective and efficient, that lays at that local level. Right? It's all at the local level.
There are thousands of videos on YouTube how to improve credit score ratings. Would you say that banking with a communal bank or a small financial institution could help individual improve credit score faster?
I think in general, this is an area where it's hard to differentiate, you know, if you're looking at averages or looking at like wide swaths of people. But mm-hmm. certainly in situations where you have a unique situation, something unique about your business, unique about what you're doing, or, you're one of one in how you're approaching what you're doing. I'll give you one example, and this might be known for the gearheads in the audience. But there's a YouTuber named Freddie Hernandez, mm-hmm. and his business is YouTube car videos, where he buys cars and he fixes them up and does different things. And he made a big splash buying a wrecked McLaren P1 that had gotten famous for having been caught in Hurricane Ian. Mm-hmm. In Florida, I think it was Fort Lauderdale. I don't remember where, but it was like there's video of this like multi-million dollar, you know, one of several hundred hypercar completely underwater, right? Ruined. Like car is completely salvaged. He buys that car and is able to make videos of him trying to revive this like mm-hmm. very rare, very, very expensive car. And he talks about like he didn't have the money to buy this. I forget. I think it was several hundred thousand dollars is what the salvage value plus what he had to put into it. But he said, I was able to finance it, right? That he had to find a very niche financer to say, hey, I'm buying this ruined car. Now, I'm not buying it because I can't finance this the way you would normally finance a car. I'm buying this as a business asset because I'm going to buy it and I'm going to work on it, but I'm going to monetize it by how I use it in my channel, right? It's basically like set dressing for an entertainment show. That is not a normal way that financing gets done, right? But he was able to find a financer that understood his business, understood what he was doing, and clearly saw the risk, unlike anybody who would normally finance a car loan, right? Mm-hmm. So there's many, many circumstances like that where, you know, you kind of go to a larger bank or a larger institution, they have a very narrow playbook, right? You are X, you go through this funnel and we check the blocks if you do there. And if you fall outside of that, nope, you know, we don't want your business, right? You can find a lot of smaller community financial institutions that will work with you because they're willing to take the time to really understand what you're doing, see what you're doing, provide you that expertise based on their like very specific knowledge, particularly when it has a local element to it, right? And help you do things that you just could not get from a larger institution.
Okay. So making these educated decisions, like investing in salvage cars that was previously almost impossible through financial institutions, do you think that data management or how they understand the market and where they get data from the market? Because it's clearly not something that these supercars are not in some register, or they don't have a price or average price they're sold, or that there's no statistic like that. The only statistic that is available is from auctions. So all this data management has to be a notch up from a normal data management in the bank when they just see average prices, what's for example, for properties price per square meter, and similar. But this is next level. So do you think IE will enable financial institutions, especially specialized financial institutions, to do more educated decisions based on the data that they're available on the internet?
Sure. No, absolutely. I'll say this, like I have a very specific point of view here, you know, just based on my experience, what I've seen, which was a lot of evaluating different use cases, right? Can we do a thing? Does this make sense? Does the technology support the whole thing? And I'll say, you know, my view of where the value is in ML and in artificial intelligence is really as an accelerator to the expert, right? A lot has been written about, you know, hey, large language models, ChatGPT, everything that's kind of come out in the past 3 to 6 months, you know, is that the end of full employment for the economy, right? You know, is this the beginning of general AI where, you know, super intelligence that passes everybody goes on? I'm not really great at predictions. I mean, that's a good way to be proven wrong an awful lot. But I'll say I'm a little bit bearish on that use case, on that happening. And it's largely on where you're going to see the biggest effect of that, particularly things like the generative AI things, is mediocre kind of goes away, right? Writing a boring press release for your generic thing, or you know, your announcement that's coming out that really doesn't require a lot of in-depth knowledge or anything, that business is gone, right? Mm-hmm. Boring and easy is done. That problem is solved.
Okay. For a small and mid-sized business owners, what do you think, which one of these three IE will affect the most? Optimization, automation, or outsourcing?
That's a good question, and pretty broad. So I mean, obviously automation, right, is a big part of it. Like we were talking about, taking away the boring, the mundane, it enables things. You know, it's probably going to better fulfill the promise that we saw in early virtual assistants, you know, like Siri, like Alexa, like okay, Google, right? All of those things where it's not just asking a question and having it look it up and give you a response, largely from structured data files, but like, you know, the to-do list of here are the five things I need to do today, do the first three for me, right? Just take care of that. I don't want that to do it. So automate a lot of the things that aren't really the best use of my time. Mm-hmm. And I guess to a certain extent that is plays into outsourcing, right? From how you put things out. I think it's probably going to take a bite out of the virtual assistant market somewhat. There's some things there, but it's also pushing them to kind of shift where they help with specific tasks and type of works that they can do. I think on the outsourcing side, some of the programming, and you see a lot of work that's done in offshore. I think a lot of that gets automated and up level to a certain extent. What was the first one? I'm sorry. We talked about automation and
how the process is going to be optimized.
Yeah. We'll have to see on that one, because when you think about optimization, it's really about wringing efficiency out of things, making it run faster or have a smaller footprint, or right, things that kind of help the economics of the business. And I think the ability to focus and specialize better, to give, you know, again, a more personalized experience for a lot of the things that you're doing. And when I say personalized, I mean like created for the individual customer, right? You're not serving a market, you're serving an individual. And the ability to like really hone what you're doing as if they were the only person in the market, that might be a pipe dream today, but it's getting closer and closer and closer. You have this more ability to do that. That's certainly going to play a piece into it. And I think those three areas, I don't know that they're completely mutually exclusive. There's a lot of overlap. So it kind of looks like a Venn diagram a little bit. But
That brings me to the next question, this optimization. In optimization processes, is it more important share intelligence or wisdom?
Yeah, no, good question. You kind of think about the difference between intelligence of like facts and figures and understanding the connection between things and wisdom of like understanding the situation, particularly where like people are involved. And I always remember there's a really good analogy in describing the difference between when something is complicated versus when it's complex. And the picture I remember seeing was they said, a mechanical Swiss watch is complicated, right? It has a lot of parts to it, but you can take it apart. You can look at a very diagram. There's a process for how watchmakers, assemble and clean and maintain and put it all back together again, and it's going to work, right? Mm-hmm. Versus looking at like how people work together, like in a social network, for example, right? That has a level of complexity because of the agency of individual pieces, right? Mm-hmm. That leaf spring in the watch is always going to be a leaf spring. You can pull it out, you can put another one in, and it's going to work exactly the same. You can take it apart and put it together 10 times. It's always going to work the same way. When there's people involved, when they have their own motivations, their own sense of style, their own wants and desires, and that are not static, that change over time, that change as they grow older, as they go through different life phases, as style changes, as like what is seen as possible changes, that is very, very hard to predict. And it is just a different, those are two different problems to solve. And I think we're seeing today a lot of things that, complicated can be solved. Complicated can be taken apart. Even if it's not rule-based, even if you're using like advanced processes like neural networks, right, where the level of complexity for complication that's going into it from, number of features that are driving that model get bigger and bigger and bigger, right, that is all well done. But for people, again, where there's agency involved, where there's like the individualism of there, like that is a very hard nut to crack. And there's a lot of things that do well from a prediction standpoint, but it is still far from being a quote unquote solved problem.
Okay. Last question before we wrap up is, would you trust any of artificial intelligence software to prioritize your to-do list?
So my duties, you say?
To-do list. So the task on your to-do list, would you trust any of AI softwares today that they would say, okay, this task is first priority, this one is second? Would
you? Got it. Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it becomes very good for helping the stuff that didn't take a lot of brain power to figure out or is boring and tedious. I don't know that we're to the point yet where it's going to solve the higher order problems, right? Because you start thinking, what's implied in that question, right? A to-do list is what's important to you? How are you going to spend your time? Okay. Am I ever going to delegate to an AI or a digital assistant the idea of, should I stay and finish this contract or should I go home and have dinner with my family? Right. Mm-hmm. That is not a decision I think I would ever be comfortable completely delegating. I certainly like some input. I like some analysis. Hey, here's pros and cons. Hey, this really needs to get done by midnight or this is what the consequences are. But that is a decision about less about my time and maybe about more who I am and what my values are. Mm-hmm. And I would be reticent to really give hands off for that, for something like that. Certainly like the suggestion, would really like a well-informed advisor to remind me of things that maybe I've forgotten of, but I don't know that I'm going to be hands-off and like giving complete control for you figure out what I should be doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to take from this interview? Any quick tips or trade secrets that you can share?
Well, I think one thing I'll talk about, since we spend a lot of time working with customers' data, is people are thinking about AI and how is it playing in there. And I think the way things are going, the way that I've seen it, is the technology around it, the methodology, the algorithm, the way kind of the sausage gets made, that is quickly becoming commoditized. You saw there was a leaked memo that kind of came out of Google about a month and a half ago. And they were kind of talking about basically how they have lost their competitive edge in this context, particularly to open source. Mm-hmm. This is a state and time discussion, and it may not stay that way, but that's really where the state of things are. Which is to say, when you're looking at this, it's one part the technology of how things get done at the algorithmic level. The other part is the data that's used to create the models. And I am a firm believer that data, particularly the first party data that you have as an organization, is only going to appreciate in value. It's going to get more and more valuable. It's going to be giving you more and more of a competitive differentiation. The things that you know about your market, your customers, how your business model works, the more that that is proprietary to you, you only know it because of your position as, say, a trusted partner to your customer or as advisor to them, or where you sit in the value chain of what you provide, that is only going to get more and more valuable. And I think today it's an undervalued asset for companies. I don't believe that broadly they understand how valuable that is and what they can potentially do with it. Again, doing things like more personalized service, more really spot on, differentiated, I'm in a market of one type offerings. So the value of first party data, big, big upside. And something that business leaders should be thinking of is not an IT issue or an IT problem. It's not just compliance. It is a business asset that will largely be generating cash flow for you in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will put links to where listener can reach you in the description below. And thank you, Rich, for being my guest tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Falaschini, for this outstanding podcast. And thank you for listening to the Ask Falaschini podcast until the end. Mr. Falaschini would love to hear your feedback in the comments. And don't forget, if you want to know, ask Falaschini or listen to the Ask Falaschini podcast. In order to please the almighty algorithm, please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.